Very much, and it's a great pleasure to be here. I have to apologize, Mr. Chairman, that I did not prepare a 40-minute lecture. I trust the audience will forgive me if I get everything I have to say into about 20 minutes. Okay, thank you for that indulgence. I did decide that I would, along, I guess, with Professor Cornea, actually address the title of the conference, which is the political consequences, political effects of economic inequality, and to take up the rather interesting and perhaps unfortunate case of the United States, which, as you are probably aware, had an extremely interesting election in 2016 quite remarkable results. And the question that I want to address this afternoon is whether the evolution of economic inequality in the United States can be said to have had a concrete or traceable effect on the political outcomes that we are now experiencing, and if so, what is the nature and direction of that effect. But before I get to that, I need to say a few words about the research basis of the work that I'm going to discuss. This is actually what I'll talk about today. It's just a small sliver of the work product of an enterprise with which I have been involved at the University of Texas now for well over 20 years. Which we call the University of Texas Inequality Project. It actually is myself plus whatever PhD and a few master's students happen to be working with me at any given time. But it is based and has been based for a long time on a basically single consistent approach to the research problem. And that has given it the advantage of accumulation, that is to say, of being able to build upon our prior work and to develop our work in a fairly consistent way over now, as I say, over two decades. This work has been largely related to the problem of measuring economic inequalities in a consistent and comparable way. And it was developed in reaction to a sense that a great deal of work in this area was either limited to the national sphere, because that's where you had a consistent set of measures, or in the international sphere, hampered by the fact that historical records were sparse and inconsistent. And in particular, although great work was done from the 1990s onward to compile international data sets of economic inequality measures, they could not be better than the comparability of the underlying research, which tended to be nationally specific survey work, and often with variations of all different kinds in the kinds of concepts that were being measured, sometimes income, sometimes consumption, sometimes households, sometimes persons, sometimes gross of tax, sometimes net of tax, you know, the spectrum of things that have been done and have been recorded. And so work that attempts to make comparisons and evaluate the course of the changes of inequality over time faces a very big problem of noise in relation to the available signal. And our approach was based on the perception that there was a lot of source material that could in fact be used very effectively to come up with measures of at least certain types of inequality, which might or might not be related to the specific types that you're interested in, but in any event had a, let's say, definite character of their own, and that could be, because they were based upon mostly administrative records and largely payroll records, but not necessarily, sometimes their census population income records, were collected in a consistent way, a systematic way over time, and so had the property that their evolution over time could be compared. And when certain types of systematization were conducted, such as putting things into consistent industrial categories, you could also, as it turns out, get reasonably plausible, and I think in fact very plausible, measures that enabled you to compare different places, different countries at any given time. So accurately and consistently measured across time and space, as against the disadvantage that you're not measuring the whole of income, you're not measuring the whole of the population, you're using information from a portion of the distribution as an instrument for being able to perceive what's going on in the distribution of a whole. What emerges from this, it seems to me, might best be described as a departure of some, I would argue, methodological significance, insofar as the prevailing literature on economic inequality has been wrapped up in a framing which is primarily microeconomic in character, that is to say, has relied on this concept, which we've heard discussed several times today, of the labor market. And the labor market is a metaphorical construction in which supply and demand interact, and the mechanism of adjustment to determine the level of employment is the wage rate. There are several different approaches to that. One, talk about the characteristics of the workers and the characteristics of the firms and what they're demanding. Or you can talk about the institutions that structure the outcomes of the labor market, and we've heard discussion of that also today. But our approach is different. Our approach permits us to look at inequality as a phenomenon that is consistent with macroeconomic phenomena that are also measured at the same level, such as the growth of output, the level of employment, and other variables that affect the economy as a whole, including noticeably foreign exchange rates, but I'll come to that in due course. And so we are in a domain which actually does not exist from the standpoint of the taxonomy of the A Journal of Economic Literature prepared by the American Economic Association, which governs our intellectual lives. If you happen to be an economist, there is no category for the macroeconomics of inequality. So the work you're about to see exists in a kind of space-time wormhole in which it simply has no identifiable category to which it can be ascribed in the literature of the economics profession as it stands now. Well, that's one of the disadvantages, I suppose, of having an original thought. I'm going to now turn to the question of sort of broadly what we know about the United States. And I'll revert to a book that I published 20 years ago, which was an initial effort to take a very data-rich environment, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, Bureau of Economic Analysis materials, including especially the employment and earnings database, and to develop a more a richer picture of the movement of various types of economic inequality. In particular, I was interested in the inequality of pay over a fairly long period of time. And this is where actually it developed the idea, where it occurred to me that we should think of this as a unified macroeconomic subject rather than something which was divided into conceptually distinct micro and macro components. What we found was that inequality of pay, and by that I mean payroll per person, which is, if you like, one of the most direct measures of what firms pay for jobs, and quite distinct from what workers' earnings, is something which tracks very closely the unemployment rate in the United States. And here's a time series that constructed quite a long time ago, only runs up to 1992, but goes back to 1920, that shows on the one hand the inequality in the pay structure of U.S. manufacturing compared to the unemployment rate, and you can see the effect of the Great Depression, the effect of the Second World War, and the effect of the recessionary instability of the 1970s on the inequality in the structure of earnings. Now, what's going on here is relatively straightforward. It's that in boom times, lower income workers not only suffer a high incidence of unemployment, they also suffer a higher incidence of short time, and they don't get overtime for their hours that they put in, or they lose second jobs, and so their pay tends to fall more rapidly than it does for salaried workers and those at the higher part of the income structure within any given industry or firm. So between industries, the inequality also goes up. The interesting fact here is that this measure tended to stabilize already in the mid-1980s with the recovery from the deep recessions of that period. So the pay inequality that we usually think of as inequality related to wages, did not follow the pattern that income inequality did in the United States. And so we have to distinguish between pay inequality and income inequality in a fairly clear-cut way. Income inequality is, in the United States, a measure which is very strongly driven by the movement of valuations in the capital markets, stock markets, also real estate markets, other markets that reflect the valuation of capital assets. And so when you look at measures of income inequality in the United States, you are looking at a tax concept. You're looking at what is reported by and large on tax forms and therefore fixed in people's minds as their incomes, as what the Internal Revenue Service tells you your income is. And the variations that have characterized measures of income inequality in the United States can be shown to be very clearly associated with the movement of capital asset prices, especially since the early 1990s. And that's partly because people have at the top end of the pay structure or the income structure have a large fraction of unearned capital income, what we used to call unearned income, of capital asset income, and partly because some of the most highly paid people in the structure of salaries are actually getting their income derived not from the cash flow of their corporations, but from venture capital flows and other things that are directly affected by the stock market, including, of course, stock options and other measures which are directly related to the valuations in the stock market. And you can see this in data which are not my data. This is the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities that breaks out the income of the top 1% and the next 19, and then the bottom middle 60 and the bottom 20. And you can see, well, income has risen in real after-tax income since 79. That's risen quite a lot, even for the lower tier of the income distribution. The big gains have been concentrated in the top 1%, and you can see the pattern of those gains corresponds very, very closely to the ebb, rise and fall, to the boom and bust, first of the stock market in the period running up to 2000, and then of asset prices generally, especially housing prices, running up to the catastrophe of the great financial crisis in 2007, and then the recovery of the stock market that began around 2010. So this is a pattern which is unmistakably connected to asset prices. The next point I would make is that while this is true of the United States, it is also true of other countries. This is not something in which the United States is a highly exceptional case. It does appear to be that way in a lot of published comparisons, including especially those done by the World Inequality Database, the WID of Thomas Piketty and his colleagues. But they have, I think, persistently neglected to take account of a major change in U.S. income tax law that occurred in the middle 1980s, which I'll come to in a second, which was called the Tax Reform Act. And if you look at this chart, what you can see is that there is a large jump in the top 1% share in the United States following 1986. I worked in the United States Congress until 1985, including on a project that led to this law, the Tax Reform Act of 1986. So I can speak from some authority as to what it was intended to do. And what it did do was to require those at the very top strata of the U.S. tax reporting system, income receivers, to report a much larger share of their actual incomes as taxable incomes, and then tax the whole lot at a lower rate, therefore leaving the burden on that part of the population just about where it was before, but causing them to report much larger adjusted gross incomes. And nothing else can account for that enormous one-year or two-year jump in the share of the top 1%. There was no recession, no crisis, no war, no grand inflation, nothing else. The big news in the economy was over in 1981, 82, 83. By 86, we were in a rather stable, ordinary recovery period. And this event is an accounting event, not a real economic event. If you correct for it in the data, you will clearly see that the data for the United States are not exceptional. They track very closely Canada and the United Kingdom with similar economic structures. Now, there are some other countries down below there, the three of them, that are marked as having substantially lower 1% shares and lower increases. They are France, Italy, and Japan. I won't speak to Japan. I can say, and this data only goes back to 75, but I've seen it back to the 60s, where in this data, the top 1% share in France is higher in the 1960s than it is today. I am sorry, I went to high school in France in the 1960s, and nobody in their right mind can possibly believe that. France in the 1960s was in a post-war recovery period under a Gaullist economic administration with a large share of nationalized industries, and had confiscated a great many assets of the collaborating class after 1945. And it was in a state of nationally directed reconstruction under very closely regulated financial controls, the encadrement de crédit and lots of other things of that kind. And no, France is not more unequal in 1965 than it was 68 when I was there than it is today. Quite the contrary, as anybody who wants to rent a flat or let alone buy one in Paris can tell you. It's just an absurdity. What we're looking at here is the relative efficiency of the French tax system when it comes to Lillian Bettencourt and other highly wealthy people. Obviously, and the fact that France borders on Switzerland and Luxembourg, not to mention Andorra and the Channel Islands, whereas the similar phenomena are much less important for the United States. Anybody who thinks otherwise, I invite you to come and have some business with the Internal Revenue Service in the U.S. You will, if you have that kind of income, you'd much rather live in France, I assure you. And as for Italy, if Italy is the same as France, I congratulate you for living in such a proletarian and socialist country, but without any oligarchs or rich people and no political forces governed by media magnates and so forth, none of those things, if you really think that. So I would just suggest that you're looking here at data that have to be reviewed extremely skeptically in light of the general, what you know to be the relative effectiveness of tax law and the culture of tax enforcement and reporting. That's not to say that the U.S. hasn't become substantially more unequal. We know that it has. It's to say that other countries have too, and that we don't have such good records on them. What has been driver of income inequality in the United States, especially on a pre-tax basis? There are surveys, by the way, on a post-tax basis that suggest that there's been very little increase in disposable income inequality in the U.S. since the 1990s. Whether you believe that or not depends upon, again, something had to do with the effect of capital incomes, but I have seen there are a substantial number of surveys that appear to make that claim based upon the data that they report. But I'm not going to go into that. What I'm going to say is that income inequality, pre-tax, the rise must be attributed largely to high-end pay and profit income fueled by capital asset bubbles, booms, and busts, and that these have been the driving force behind U.S. economic growth and transformation and rising inequality for at least the last 40 years. Now, the interesting effect of this, and I'm going to come down to the question of the effect on politics, is that a very uneven pattern of income is also going to result in a large continental economy in a very uneven geographic distribution of that income. And some years ago, a student of mine and I did a little exercise on county incomes in the United States in the 1990s, measuring income inequality across counties. And we discovered that if you took five counties out of the mix, five out of 3,150 accounted for one half of the increase in between county income inequality in the U.S. between 1993 and the peak of the information technology boom in 2000. Which five were they? One of them was New York, New York, Manhattan, Wall Street, the financial center. Three were Santa Clara, San Mateo, and San Francisco counties in California, Silicon Valley. And one more was King County, Washington, which is Seattle, which is Microsoft. And that was half. If you took out 15, the entire increase in between county inequality in the U.S. went away. So the concentration of incomes is very, very geographically specific. The incomes booked in those places are absolutely stratospheric, and that's what's driving the data. But this then has produced, over 40 or 30 years, a massive change in the character of the political alignments in the United States. And that's what we see evident in the vote that occurred in 2016. The red, these are county by county results. The red are those counties that voted for Mr. Trump. The blue are those counties that voted for Secretary Clinton. And what do you see? What do you observe? You can see that the Clinton counties are coastal and along the frontiers of the country. They run from the northeast down through a belt in the middle south, up along the Texas border with Mexico, and then they dominate the population centers of the far west. Everything else is substantially Trump country. Right? So it's an exceedingly interesting geographic pattern, and it has a interaction with institutions that is decisive for determining how this translates into a presidential election result in the United States. And if that, I get to a point that I would make about the relationship of institutions generally to the macroeconomic forces that are driving increased inequality. Institutions modify and channel those forces. In some cases, they can restrain it. And I would argue on a global scale, you have macroeconomic forces raising inequality, but some countries with stronger institutions, including stronger trade unions and social welfare states, have been able to resist the effect of those forces more effectively than others. And it's the same thing if big boats resist the effect of a storm more effectively than small boats. Big aircraft are more stable in turbulence than small aircraft. The same phenomenon with respect to countries and the macro forces driving the growth of inequality around the world. Well, in the United States, the presidential elections are determined not by a popular vote, but as you know, by the outcomes in the Electoral College, which is a long-standing institution that has the peculiar property that it allocates 100% of a state's electoral votes, which are roughly proportional to population, to the candidate that gets the plurality in the state. And all other votes are essentially wasted. So more than one extra vote, and the extra votes have an actual value of zero. In this election, Mrs. Clinton won California by about, I think, 4 million votes, but 3.9 million of those were wasted from that point of view. They had no extra effect on the outcome. So the question that we then asked was, is it possible to relate the outcomes in the Electoral College in 2016 to the change in inequality state by state over an extended period of time? And the problem with asking that question was that until we looked at it, there were no systematic data that would give you measures of inequality on an annual basis, on a state-by-state basis. And the reason for that is the census, which did give those numbers, is only once every 10 years. The current population survey, which is every year, is only 60 or 80,000 households. And there are plenty of states that are very small. And a national survey of that size does not give you a reliable estimate of what's going on in North Dakota or Rhode Island or Wyoming or Alaska or any of a number of places. But using the techniques that we had developed over years of working on the global economy, we went down to state level data and calculated estimates of inequality across basically earning sectors at very really fine level of detail, and calculated the movement of inequality the level of inequality year to year in each state, and therefore the movement from one period year to the other. We picked 1990 as a reasonable starting point and calculated the increase in inequality for each state from 1990 to 2014. Well, it was an election which was strongly fought on a populist uprising against the status quo. And many people, when I raised this, said to me, well, that they would assume that the states with the highest increases in inequality were the ones that voted for Donald Trump in a rebellion against the status quo. And that, as I'll show you now, is precisely the opposite of what actually occurred. These are, each of these little figures represents one state of the United States. The size of the figures is proportional to their weight in the Electoral College. The blue diamonds are the states